This is Tea Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. Angel 1. Hello and welcome to episode 47 of Tea Earl Grey Heart, an unofficial Star Trek fan podcast from the Other Side Podcast Network. My name is Dave and I am joined this week, as always, by someone who, through the miracle of the modern internet, is joining us live from his home studio in the northwest of Sweden. Hello, Yannick.
What? What is this nonsense?
I felt I had to redress the balance. So, dear listeners, my lovely wife and I have started doing a radio show in our local town. And we played an artist called the Diablo Swing Orchestra, who are based out of Stockholm. And when Caroline was reading out the blurb about the band, despite the fact that it had the right information in front of her, she said it was Stockholm, Switzerland, and not Stockholm, Sweden.
Yes.
Anyway, back to Star Trek. On this week's show, we'll be giving our review of Star Trek: The Next Generation, Season 1, Episode 14, Angel 1. Yeah. And again, I don't think we've got anything to discuss, but I think the episode will probably be enough in itself.
Yeah. I find that we're reaching about an hour and a half with our reviews, so I think it's a good time. We don't need to rumble.
To clarify, that's an hour and a half edited time, not an hour and a half recorded time. By any means, nowhere near.
About 47 hours recording.
Pretty much, yes. Anyway, so enough waffle. I think we should crack straight on with our review of Star Trek: The Next Generation, Season 1, Episode 14, Angel 1. So in the teaser, the USS Enterprise D has discovered the wreckage of the Odin, a freighter that disappeared 7 years earlier. It was disabled by a collision with an asteroid, and there are no life signs on board. But three escape pods are missing, suggesting that there may be survivors. The Enterprise travels to Angel 1, the nearest M-class planet, to begin their search. Riker is concerned that any survivors from the impact with the asteroid may not have made it to Angel 1, as it would have taken 5 months for the escape pods to reach the planet, a distance that the Enterprise managed to cover in 2 days at Warp 1.
Yeah, I can imagine 5 months in a essentially what is what do you call that, tin box?
Yes.
You know, we pretty much established by now that escape pods like shuttles don't have the necessaries. Management, you know, things for long distance travels.
Exactly.
So 5 months.
Yes. So it does make you wonder what happened to that crew. They wouldn't have had provisions. I wouldn't have thought so. No. Maybe they had a replicator. I don't know.
Maybe.
Maybe they started off with more people than they ended up with. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Data again. 5 months, 6 days, 11 hours, 2 minutes, and apparently 57 seconds. And I couldn't help noticing that when Riker said, "Thank you, Data," translation, "Shut up, Data," he said the 57 seconds bit with the smuggest, most cheeky look on his face that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Probably.
It's funny because when he started, you know, counting 5 months, 6 days, I said out loud about at the same time as Riker, you know, "Thank you, Data." And I was like, "Yeah, okay." I, you know, we now know the dynamic between the characters. And as you said last week, there are the characters, the actors now are in their characters, so we can feel the mechanics between them, and it's getting very good.
Yeah, and you can certainly see that the Data as a character is starting to evolve. He's starting to get a lot more. Brent Spiner is starting to get a lot more into the part than before, and he's making it his own, which is really, really good to see.
Absolutely, yes.
Angel One is a female-dominated society ruled by 6 elected mistresses and a leader known simply as the Elected One. Troy remarks that this is not unlike her own planet, and Worf says that he appreciates strong women, which, of course, we know from Hyden Q when he had the Klingon... No, I don't want to talk about that now. it has been 62 years since the last Federation contact with the planet. Now, we don't know which vessel made contact, as it falls outside of the time period covered by the current slate of Star Trek series. Maybe as time goes on and a series comes in to fill that gap, there'll be a story about that one. So we don't really know what that contact would have been.
No, and I was confused that at the beginning I thought the Odin was the first ship to make contact, or was going to make contact, and so I didn't understand this reference, but then I figured that it was too... those were two independent contacts that maybe the Odin didn't even have planned to make contact with that planet.
By all accounts, they haven't made contact.
Yeah.
If they've just kind of landed on the planet and then went into hiding straight away.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Mm. Picard offers Troy the opportunity to make initial contact with the planet, as it is a female-dominated society. The Enterprise hails the planet, and Troy speaks with the Elected One, Mistress Beata. Although initially wary, she agrees to let an away team beam down to visit the planet. I think the exact phrase was, "A brief visit will be tolerated." Well, that sounds like fun, doesn't it?
Not very friendly.
No.
no visual contact, and as Jordi mentioned, said, "Well, I just lost." It's something like, that doesn't make you feel welcome or something like that, yeah.
Yes. No, absolutely. I did start to thinking as to why they were reluctant to have visitors. And I don't know whether this is because they were representatives from the Federation or whether it was they do that with every visiting ship that comes past. But I wonder whether they were concerned that an external visitor was going to come in and judge them for how they operated their society.
I don't want to say too much because we have some explanation at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
But I really think it's more what actually happened, that more people from outside would, you know, make what is happening on the planet worse. Mm. So that's what I think now in retrospect. You know, it's always easier to say that once you've seen the whole episode.
No, of course. I mean, one thing they do say later on, but I've not covered in the review, is that they refer to themselves as a remote planet. So they're already well aware they live far outside the realms of normal civilization. So they may not get any, you know, passing visitors.
Yeah.
So on to Act 1 then. As the away team of Riker, Troy, Data and Yar head for the transporter room, they encounter Wesley and a friend entering the holodeck for a skiing lesson.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, why not?
I mean, you have a holodeck, so use it for, all those things that you probably will never do for real.
Well, absolutely. That's exactly, I presume that's what it's there for. You're going to be stuck on that ship for 5+ years. The last thing you want to do is, you know, spend your holiday in someone else's quarters. You want to go, well, maybe you do, I don't know. But no, you want to go somewhere nice. And if you can create something, then yeah, go ahead and do it. And seeing Wesley and his friend, who I don't think we have a name for.
No, and I don't think he said a single line.
No, I don't believe so. They went in there and started throwing snowballs at each other. So, you know, it did its job.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I would have probably, you know, I would have brought my ski combination, suit, with me and have the computer replicator a place to change, you know, instead of walking around in the spaceship in my ski outfit.
Okay.
But yeah, but who knows? Maybe in the 24th century they have, you know, gear that don't hit, like, you know, that don't make you feel very hot when you're not actually skiing. Because I guess it's about 20 degrees in the corridors of the Enterprise, something like that.
I would imagine,
say an average Celsius degrees, of course, which is something else in Fahrenheit. Sorry for our American friends.
No, they should be apologizing to us.
I would probably have replicated something to change inside the holodeck, but why not? I mean,
I presume that's a thing, is it? You can replicate clothing.
Yeah. Yeah, probably, yeah. I don't know.
But the clothing they were wearing didn't look particularly safe, protective,
no,
you know, at all. So no, maybe that's what they had around at the time. I certainly wouldn't want to fall down a hillside in that.
No. Although, who knows, it might be Kevlar or something like that.
Probably. On Angel 1, the females are as aggressively dominant as the male gender was on Earth hundreds of years ago. The females display many of the characteristics that males on Earth had, being stronger, being physically larger, and the opposite equally applies to the males.
Yeah, as we can see in this scene.
Yeah. The away team beam down to the planet where they meet with Beata and ask about any survivors that might be on the planet. Still suspicious, she asks why they're only coming now, and Troy explains that the Enterprise's discovery of the freighter was unexpected. Their only purpose in coming is to simply find any survivors and bring them home. Another member of the Council, Ariel, expresses her misgivings, and Beata refuses to tell them if there are any survivors. Instead, Beata's male servant, Trent, takes them to another room. Troy reckons that Beata's refusal to tell them about the survivors confirms that there are, in fact, survivors. Which is fairly logical.
Absolutely. Although at this time I didn't understand, as the away team, why she would refuse to tell them that there are survivors. Mm.
I noticed that.
Well, go ahead.
No, go on.
I agree with Beata. Why would they wait for so long? I mean, the ship was hit by an asteroid, so there was a whole crew on this ship. So why didn't the Federation search for the ship earlier?
Well, the only thing we know about that ship is that it was a freighter, not a starship. So I don't know what the protocol is for that, whether the Federation even... Well, they must have known, because it was a Federation ship. But no, I don't know. I don't know. It does seem a bit odd that a ship disappears and they don't know about it.
Yeah, and nobody goes to look for it. But anyway.
It's a fair question. Mm-hmm. I noticed that Riker tried to intervene at one point, but was really, really neatly sidelined as Beata responded to Troy, referring to Riker as this man.
Yeah.
That and really set the scene for how things are on that planet.
Yeah. And his reaction was, it was, what?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yep. In your place, yeah. Riker.
Yeah.
Mm.
Take that, Commander.
I was also quite distracted during that scene because I recognized one of the actresses from another TV series that we have spoken about before quite recently.
Oh, yeah. Knight Rider.
Yes, exactly. Patricia McPherson.
I'm looking for her character's name.
Bonnie.
Bonnie.
Yeah. Back on the Enterprise, Picard tells Worf in the turbo lift that they have to prepare for a trip to the neutral zone when the away team returns, as Romulan battle cruisers have been detected near one of the Federation's border posts. As they pass the holodeck, they are hit by a snowball thrown by Wesley. Oh, absolutely brilliant.
That's the second time Wesley encounters Picard at the exiting an holodeck and doing stupid stuff. In the pilot, he was drenched in water when he got out of the holodeck and met Picard for the first time.
Yes. I don't know whether this is a thing going forward, because I haven't seen most of the episodes in the series, but I kind of hope it is, because it is funny. It's comical to see Picard's reaction.
Everything is possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Other bits not.
So, we spoke about this before, possibly last week. The holodeck.
Yeah.
Firstly, why was the door open? If they were inside, in the...
Was too cold inside.
Let the warm air in, yes. Oh, dear. I've got more about that scene, but I'll wait till the end.
Yeah, but also, how... Same thing as last week, no, the week before. How come the snowball could get out of the holodeck?
Yep.
I mean, it's a hollow projected snowball. It should have stopped at the door.
Yes, or disintegrated or whatever. Yeah, whatever. No, quite right. Picard detects an unusual smell that Worf identifies as a night-blooming throngy, which is a Klingon scent. And Worf's... He said these words, I kid you not. He said, quite stimulating, don't you think? To Picard. Now, you don't say things like that to your commanding officer, seriously.
No. No, you don't.
You really don't.
No. Well, we now know what's that now that we've seen the episode, but it was strange. It was like what? What is that? Where does that come from?
Well, they wouldn't have included it for no reason. Obviously, it has some relevance to later on in the episode, but of course, at this time we don't. It's just one of those observational things that may or may not have a relevance later on. So. In that scene, I spotted two bloopers.
Okay.
The first one is during the conversation with Wesley, both Worf and Picard had water on their uniforms.
Yeah.
And yet at the point they turned away to walk away from the holodeck door, they were dry.
That's because it's hollow water and then it disappeared.
Nope, not buying that. Okay.
I tried.
All right.
I tried.
Explain this one then.
Okay.
When we saw Picard and Worf, Worf was on Picard's right. So on the left-hand side from our viewpoint.
Yes.
When they turned and walked away, Worf was on Picard's left. So they're on our right-hand side.
That's because they turn on their feet and went the other way.
Now, I thought that might have been the case, because if they both turned to their left, then Worf would be almost directly behind Picard, and he could have come up on the left hand side. But the timing of the scene didn't seem to allow that.
Okay, yeah,
so it could be a blooper. So. It could be just a mistiming of the scene, or I could just be reading too much into things as normal.
Or a combination of the three.
Yes. Data is investigating some perfume when Trent returns to bring them back to the council chambers. Beata tells them that, although the decision was not unanimous, they have decided to tell them about the survivors. She says there were four of them. Seven when they started. Told you. She said there were four of them, and their leader is a man called Ramsay. However, they are now fugitives in hiding. Sometime after arriving on Angel One, they started to abuse the hospitality they'd received and began to cause trouble. She warns Troy that they are dangerous.
Yeah, I was thinking, I think she said that they started to make unreasonable demands or things like that, and I was really confused about what it was they could have done, except maybe that being humans and male humans, they were, I can understand how they would resent the Angel One's society.
Yes,
but going from there to essentially making them outlaws, I thought it was a bit far-fetched. But it turns out that no, it was actually a pretty mild reaction.
Yeah, or they might have decided to become outlaws themselves. Well, if you have two dominant genders, you've got a female dominant society and four males from a essentially male-dominated environment, they're going to clash immediately. But not only that, there's also going to be the, let's call it the natural progression of things, which is probably more along the lines of the unreasonable demands they were talking about.
Yeah, probably.
But there was a mention, and I can't remember whether it was here or later on, that they took exception to how the males in their society were being treated.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, that could have been part of it as well. Just as a side note, twice in this review, and I've actually submitted these as corrections, mentions of Troy were actually specified as Riker. So, for example, I have to find the example now. Troy explained that the Enterprise's discovery of the freighter was unexpected. But actually, in the review, it said Riker. And I actually thought that was a classic example of life imitating art. So what seems to have happened there is where Troy is obviously acting as the superior for the group, because she's been said that she can act as intermediary between the crew and the Angel One-ians. Whoever wrote the review has automatically sided with the person who they would have expected to have spoken those things, which in this case should have been Riker, following the chain of command.
That person should be banned from Memory Alpha.
It's all right, I've covered it up for them.
You're too good.
Yeah, I wish I'd waited, though, because I did one edit after the other rather than one edit of both errors.
Yeah.
So, we are on to Act 2. Meanwhile, Dr. Crusher tells Picard that Wes and his friend are sick with a respiratory ailment. She is, however, working on a vaccine. Picard reminds her that they are on an important Starfleet mission and they cannot afford to have the crew going down with an infection. Now, I noticed at this point, Picard kind of stretched out his neck a bit, as if he had some kind of muscular aching, And they spent a bit too long concentrating on that for that to not mean anything. So clearly he wasn't feeling too well at the time.
That and the little sound effect when he put his hand on his neck, that, you know,
the tension you music. Have.
No, the sound effect, the same one we had in The Naked Now when they were touching each other, you heard this hiss. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
As in, okay, and now we know that he's sick.
On the planet, Data suggests that they can locate the survivors by searching for platinum, an element not found on Angel 1, but which would have been brought by the survivors. Riker asks Mistress Beata to allow Data access to their library. Beata, rather loftily, says that the library is far too sophisticated for a man to comprehend.
Yeah.
Yes, an Angel 1 male, perhaps. Did she not consider that in the society of the visitors, that maybe the males may have been able to understand?
Yes, true.
Yes.
Yeah, but that was funny.
Data points out that he is an android, although anatomically male and fully functioning too.
Fully functional.
Beata finds the notion of a male android rather amusing, but she permits access to the library anyway, suggesting that they may be able to teach the native males a thing or two. And I presume that was to do with the library, not about the fully functional and anatomically male android.
Yeah, I hope so.
They're asking for these things. They really are. Picard asks LaForge to begin the search. Riker is brought an outfit worn by one of the men of the planet, as he wants to wear it when he meets Beata, to impress her by wearing indigenous apparel. Troy and Yar find his appearance wearing the outfit hilarious, however. Riker wonders whether their objections to him wearing the outfit might have something to do with Beata being a woman, and an attractive one at that.
No.
Never even crossed my mind.
What? Oh, she's a woman. That's true.
Oh, is she attractive? I hadn't noticed.
No, me neither. The reaction of Troy and Yar was hilarious.
It was good. They were trying so hard and really badly not to laugh.
I guess Marina Sirtis and
Denise Crosby.
I forgot that name. Denise Crosby, yeah. I guess they had fun. I wonder if they had seen Jonathan Frakes dressed like that before they shot the scene. That would have been so fun, you know, that they did that.
I think it would have been so much better had this been a natural reaction to it rather than a scripted one.
It seemed to be a natural reaction. Mm. I mean, you can tell sometimes when actors, you know, they act, you know, laughing and things like that. This seems really genuine.
It does. I'm sorry, for the record, this is my genuine opinion. You can quote me on this. William T. Riker, you are a tart. He really is. And there's more of it later on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Back on the Enterprise, Dr. Crusher examines Captain Picard, pronouncing him unfit for command as he appears to be displaying symptoms of the virus and orders him to bed. Did I miss something? He went from having a slight ache to now being bedridden.
Yeah. It's the B-plot, so, you know, I'll forgive them for that.
Yeah, I suppose it is. I mean, it doesn't have any relevance to the primary storyline at all, does it?
No relevance whatsoever.
Yeah.
Oh, and I liked the dialogue when she said he said I have an appointment with or a rendezvous with with someone. I said, oh, you have an appointment with your bed. Mm.
Is that an order, Doctor? Yes, it is. Yeah.
Those two also get in their characters now. Those two actors and the mechanics between the two characters.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. The chemistry between them is starting to form.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is good. Because even though that was most definitely a battle of supremacy, because you've got two people, both of which have command over the other, mm-hmm. based on different circumstances. Yep. But the way they did it was almost casual. Yes, Picard did say, "Is that an order?" And she did say, "Yes, it is." But it didn't seem like it was an authoritative command. It was more like, "Come on, mate, you need to do this."
Yeah. A friendly order.
Yeah, if you like.
If there's such a thing.
On the bridge, Worf tells Geordi that you may have to sneeze. A Klingon sneeze, asks Geordi. Only kind I know.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Picard enters the bridge and tells LaForge that he has command of the ship. LaForge sits in the captain's chair, and Worf tells him that the Platinum has now been located on the planet. Now, LaForge obviously enjoyed sitting in the captain's chair, relishing the experience, including uttering the words "make it so" when Worf asks him if he should tell the away team about the Platinum. Worf's reaction to that was classic.
Yeah. Yeah. When Picard gave the bridge to LaForge, he also said, "Make sure to make the proper ship's log." I don't know if he was, making sure, because it's probably the first time Geordi had the bridge, so making sure that he was aware of that, or it almost seemed like, you know, he was like me when I tell my daughter something that she was supposed to know, but you know, she kind of probably forgot on purpose. So I was confused. But I'd like to think that it was because he wanted to make sure, because of Geordi's first command.
Yeah, I mean, he is a lieutenant.
Yeah.
So he's a good few steps away from having command of a ship anyway. So I saw Picard's comment as more of a training, coaching, mentoring thing.
Okay, yeah.
Than anything else. And also possibly a little bit of pride on Picard's side, because we know Picard makes regular and very, what's the word I'm looking for here? Detailed log entries.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, if he's now out of the way and someone else has got command of the ship, he wants to make sure that those regular detailed logs are still going in, so that when he gets back out again, he still has responsibility of the ship.
Yeah.
Even though somebody else is in command of it, he's going to have to answer to it later on.
Absolutely, yes.
Riker appears in front of Troy and Yar wearing the new outfit. they try unsuccessfully not to laugh at his appearance, although Yar thinks it looks quite sexy. Riker remarks that it's quite comfortable as he leaves the room.
Yeah, so we were a little bit in advance in our comments, but yeah, absolutely funny.
Brilliant. Riker meets with Beata and tells her that the Enterprise has now found the location of the survivors. Ariel is still suspicious and tells Riker this before storming out. I thought the challenge by Ariel of, "I hear the words, but not the sincerity," which Riker then turns around and throws straight back at her during their exchange of mistrust. I thought that was quite clever.
Yeah. Although again, we now know why she did that, but I was wondering what that meant. That there was something clearly not right with that character.
I think she was... Oh, yeah, of course. This is where hindsight plays a really big part in this, because obviously, having seen the rest of the episode, we know the reason why.
Yeah.
But the issue that Ariel had with the Enterprise turning up is the length of time it's taken for them to mount effectively this rescue mission.
Mm-hmm.
And for reasons which are now, at the moment, not very obvious, she is incredibly passionate about this particular statement. And if you're watching this for the first time, you wouldn't know the reason why.
Yeah.
And of course, Riker doesn't know. So Riker tries to explain to the reasons why they're there. The fact that they, they're there incidentally. They weren't there to mount a rescue mission. They just happened to come across the Odin as they were on their way to somewhere else.
Yeah.
So yeah. Yeah.
But everything is going to be clear in the end.
Yes. In a twist, I didn't see coming. Just saying.
No.
Oh, we're winding our listeners up now. Riker waits with
Bayard. We have two viewers.
Sorry?
We have two viewers.
We have two. Ooh.
In the YouTube channel.
I know who. Well, one of them's probably me.
Oh, okay. So because we had one. Oh, so maybe we've lost we've lost Laney in for a while.
I don't know.
Who? So let's take this occasion to say hello to Laney in our YouTube chat room.
Our and communications officer.
Once again. Yeah. And we will give you all the information later on in this episode.
Riker waits with Beata, asking for her approval to begin the search. She agrees, but says they don't need him to initiate the search. No, he can stay with her and give her the gesture of goodwill that he promised her. I'm like, wow. How obvious can you be?
More than that, impossible. No.
Oh, dearie me. It gets worse.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I didn't see that one coming.
No, really?
No.
Riker tells Yar to begin the search while he stays behind to maintain diplomatic relations, he says with air quotes. Yar.
Yeah.
Diplomatic relations, right. Yar, Data, and Troy beam to the location of the Platinum, a cave mouth where they meet a man who says he's been expecting them.
Dun, dun, dun.
I didn't know how he would have known to expect them.
No. Which adds to the mystery.
It does that.
Or maybe he was expecting them, you know, he's been expecting them for 6 years. Sitting there, waiting, knowing that someone would beam and say, "Hey, we found your ship. How are you?"
I think if you've been waiting 6 years, you would have done more than say, "Hey, I've been waiting, been expecting you. Where on earth have you been?"
Yeah.
So we are on to Act 3. Picard, visibly struggling under the effects of the virus, calls LaForge from his quarters for a status report. After a rather wholesome Klingon sneeze from Worf, Geordi tells Picard that there are 82 more cases of the virus, and Dr. Crusher has converted a holodeck to deal with it. After another tremendous sneeze, Worf observes that he's getting sick. No.
No.
So Geordi tells him to report to sickbay. Geordi then receives a report from engineering regarding the climate controls and is just about to leave the bridge when Worf gently reminds him that there are people to do that now. As Worf leaves for sickbay, Geordi thanks him for the advice. And I think that was an incredibly good shout-out by Worf. A very good example of teamwork. That just a little reminder, you can't leave the bridge, you're in charge of the ship.
Yes, because if I recall... correctly, Worf and Geordi were the only one on the bridge at that time.
Yes.
So Worf going to sickbay and Geordi going to engineering would have left the bridge.
Exactly.
Unmanned. Yeah. Not that anyone would steal the Enterprise, you know, It's not like you leave your car with the doors open somewhere in the wild, but still.
Is it much better to have one person on the bridge than it is to have no people on the bridge?
Because I don't think it changes anything, you know, for the control of the ship, but as the officer, you know, when Picard left, he said, "You've got the bridge." So that's a meaning that not only means that you're in command, it means you have to be on the bridge because you're the one who's in charge of everything, and you have to be there.
Yeah, absolutely. But if everything kicks off, red alert, under attack, all the rest of it, there's not really a lot he can do by himself.
Nope.
Not when you have a full complement of, is it 7 or 8? Possibly more on the Enterprise bridge.
Yeah.
I suppose he could do everything from Science Station 2, can't he?
Yeah, sure.
There is that. Meanwhile, Yar tells Ramsay how they found him and tells him that they're bringing him home. He shocks them by saying he doesn't want to leave, as he and the others are happy. They have wives and, in some cases, children. How can you rescue someone from a place they call home?
That should have, make them think, because there were 4 of them, I think.
Yeah.
And now he says that they've got wives.
Well, there's only one place you can get wives from.
Yeah, and none of Data, Yar, or Troy tilted and said, "Wait a minute, where did you get wives from?"
And I have to admit, I didn't think about that until you said it right then.
Ah, okay. So I was like, "Wait, what?"
Mm. Now, Ramsay did say that they were packing up to leave anyway. I didn't get that. I didn't understand why they were packing up to leave.
No. Me neither.
Unless they're nomads and they have to move from various places in order to stay undetected.
Yeah. That could make sense. You know, they've escaped being caught for 6 years, so they probably didn't stay at the same place for 6 years.
Yeah.
Which it then makes it even more understandable. That he was expecting them here. You know, if they are moving anyway, and now he says, "We're expecting you." So we know why, obviously, now, but...
Whilst I understand that they are all people of the Federation, because the freighter that they were, that the Odin is, was a Federation freighter. So I would imagine that Ramsay is aware of the capability of a starship. So they must have realized that they had something with them that would have made them stand out from the rest of the world. The platinum wings he was wearing.
He said he kept them it's almost an accident that he still had them. So he didn't keep them intentionally to be detected or something like that.
Yeah. Of course, we know why he was expecting them, but we don't know that yet.
No.
Beata tells Riker that Ramsay and his friends are anarchists and outlaws. She starts flirting with him, and as they start to kiss, Trent walks in with a present that Riker has brought for her. He shows her the Albany meditation crystal... before they get back to kissing.
Yeah, I called BS. This is just a piece of plastic with a
light bulb in it.
A light inside. And it was ugly.
I have nothing to say about it. It was just a piece of cheap toot, to be honest.
I thought, what is this? It was horrible.
Whatever it was, the switch to operate it was like deep inside, because they had to like put a stick in the top of it to switch it on. And even then, it looked like a piece of plastic with a light bulb inside it.
Yeah.
And
which it what it was.
Which is exactly what it was. And as love scenes go, that was just cringeworthy. if you put together everything about romantic scenes that you find bad from any film you've ever watched or any set of films you've ever watched and put them all into one scene, that was it.
Yeah.
It really was cringeworthy.
Yeah.
Ramsay tells the rest of the away team that at first they thought Angel One was great, but then they saw how the men had no respect and were discriminated against. When they spoke out, they were forced to become fugitives. He refuses to leave, and Data adds that they can't force him, as he and his crew are not members of Starfleet, and therefore they do not have to obey the Prime Directive. Now, I didn't know that.
Me neither.
I thought that as they were part of the Federation, that the Prime Directive applied to them as well. But apparently, I did some digging into this, it only applies to starships and... Oh, I had it right in front of me. Marine somethings.
Yeah, that's what Data said. That since they were Odin was not a starship, they don't have to obey the Prime Directive.
But I didn't realize. I thought the Federation's. Well, actually, because the Prime Directive is not Federation; it's Starfleet. Mm-hmm. It's Starfleet's General Order Number 1, I think it's called officially.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense.
Back on Enterprise, Crusher tells LaForge that there are more sick than beds, and he remarks that they'd be seriously undermanned if they were forced to take action against the Romulans. Yar contact.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, good, go please. I'm carrying on.
No, I don't know if she was, if Crusher was in sickbay or in the shelter in the holodeck, but apparently they don't know they don't have protection gear in the Enterprise because she was walking around, everybody was sick, and she didn't have any kind of mask or gloves or things like that. So I don't know, maybe she's thought she was already sick and didn't see any use for that, but I found that a bit strange.
Hmm.
Especially given, the circumstances of the world right now, where you don't even dream of boarding a train without a mask.
No.
So,
just as an aside, I did pick up earlier in the scene when. Geordi told Picard that there were 82 more cases of the virus. Well, we found out today here in the UK that there are 85 more cases of the virus in the last 24 hours. And I'd literally just found that out, so I found that quite funny. Yeah. In a not very funny way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yar contacts LaForge, asking to beam the three of them to their previous location, where they will regroup with Riker and return to the ship. He informs them that one third of the crew is now infected and more Romulan vessels are converging in the neutral zone. Ramsay won't tell them how he knew they were coming, but after they beam away, Ariel comes out of the cave and kisses him.
That's why.
And now everything becomes crystal clear.
Yeah.
Yes. A lot makes sense now.
Yeah, now we know why he was expecting them.
Yes, absolutely. And it also explains her emotional outburst in the... Mm-hmm. I presume there were council chambers or something earlier on, and why she was battling with Riker.
Yeah.
Wyker? William T. Wyker. Riker is with Beata when Trent enters and tells her that the away team hasn't got the survivors. Yar fills in Riker, and then Beata says that she is forced to sentence the survivors to death.
Yeah.
That's logical.
Yeah, that's a bit harsh. Yeah.
Yeah, can't get rid of them, kill them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that gets even worse later on when she actually explains what why and what she did. We'll come back to that when we get there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was like, you know, when she started, walking away and say, oh, well, if you can't bring them, or I don't know what she said, I was like, okay, she's going to make them prisoner. She would keep the awaiting or something like that. No, why keep the awaiting prisoner when you can just kill the outlaws?
Yeah. Well, if they're fugitives, and I think that Beata mentioned earlier on that they're unable to locate them because they don't have the technology required to do it or something along those lines. But now they know where they are, that... hang on.
No, so
they don't know where they are, do they?
No.
But they know that the crew of the Enterprise know where they are.
Yeah, well, they kind of know, as we will see later.
Well, they will know very soon, yes.
Yeah.
So, Act 4. Dr. Crusher visits Picard in his quarters to give him some medicine and notices the same odour that Picard smelled at the holodeck. She realises that this is the way that the virus spreads.
I don't know how she realises that, but yep, good call.
I could understand how she would have accepted it as a theory, but she was like, yes, this is how it happened.
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't have time to investigate a theory at this point.
Yeah, well, as I said, it's the B plot. We don't know anything about that virus. We don't know how it, you know, arrived. We don't really know how she got rid of it, but that's okay.
Down on the planet, Data tells Riker that 7 Romulan battlecruisers are now in the vicinity of the outpost, and the USS Berlin has responded to the distress call. However, the presence of the Enterprise is still regarded as a vital show of strength by Starfleet. Yar points out that the mere presence of the Enterprise may be sufficient, but if things turn ugly, they may not cope with a third of the crew being incapacitated.
Yeah, she even said that the Enterprise could go there on autopilot.
Yes, exactly.
Which makes you wonder why they have 7% on the bridge.
Yes. Riker suggests that they need to leave, but Troy isn't comfortable leaving when there's a death sentence in place for the Odin survivors. Riker believes that they're safe, as they've managed to evade capture for years. Suddenly, Troy gets a feeling that something is wrong, just before Beata and Trent enter the room, closely followed by Ramsey and his crew, whom Beata found by having Ariel followed. Ha. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who needs technology?
Absolutely.
She tells Riker that the fugitives are to be executed tomorrow. Riker is outraged and asks her for another chance to convince Ramsey and his followers, including Ariel, to leave with them. She agrees, but Ramsey still won't go. Riker wants to beam them aboard anyway, but Data points out that forcing anyone to leave against their will would be a violation of several regulations, including the Prime Directive. Riker says he would rather face a court-martial than the guilt of leaving people to die.
Yeah, I don't know if I would agree with that. I mean, if they choose to stay knowing what is going to happen to them, I can see his point, but I can also see their point. It's a tough one.
It is. It's a reaction that I would have expected from Riker. I don't think he would have come up with anything different. But
doesn't mean I fully agree with him. But yeah.
See, I do and I don't. I totally agree with the ethics of it. You know, you don't want to leave people to die because that's not a nice thing to do. But at the same time, the Prime Directive is still in effect here. So they were living on the planet. The rules of that planet are that they get executed. So you shouldn't interfere with that process, regardless of your moral and ethical feelings on the matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a catch-22.
Yeah, absolutely is. It's all moot, however, as Dr. Crusher won't allow anybody to come aboard the ship. LaForge has succumbed to the virus, and Crusher cannot find a cure. After confirming that the virus won't affect him, Riker orders Data to beam up and take the Enterprise to the neutral zone before it's too late.
Yes. So, how can Crusher be sure that Data won't be affected when we know that he was affected by the virus from...
The Naked Now.
The Naked Now. So, I guess it's it depends on how the writers need Data to react.
They probably didn't expect two middle-aged people sat down behind microphones picking holes in... the thing is, it's comparing episodes to episodes.
Yeah.
Which we probably shouldn't be doing, but it's fun, so we do it. Yeah, I don't know. Anywho, so Act 5 then.
Yeah.
The next day, Trent invites them to come to the execution. What a lovely invitation that is. Yeah. Data contacts them and says that they still have time before their ship has to leave for the neutral zone. 47 minutes, to be exact.
Yay!
Now, unsurprisingly, I looked into this. I'm fairly confident that was probably the first acknowledged reference of the number 47. Because according to the Memory Alpha article on the number 47, the one of the writers of TNG didn't start including references to the number 47 as a matter of course until season 4.
Okay.
So anything that we have up to this point, up to when season 4 starts, is incidental. It's, you know, wasn't included intentionally.
Okay. Well, it's a good coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you pick up on the thing that you caught me out for not picking up before? When Riker was talking to Data on his comm badge, he was looking up to the sky.
No, I didn't.
That the noise would have been coming from his comm badge, not from up there.
Well, we actually don't know that because of how it's made on TV. Would the noise come from the comm badge, or would it come from any audio system around them, depending on where they stand on the ship? You know, as if they're on the bridge, there's this
Riker's on Angel One.
Loudspeaker. Huh, yeah.
Although I agree with what you're saying, if they were on the bridge, certainly. So because you could put an Alexa anywhere, couldn't you?
Yeah. Maybe each time they use their communicator, there's a mini hollow loudspeaker that's projected outside of the camera field of view. And they have to... No. Yeah, okay.
I was about to agree with you, but you said no, so bad luck.
Maybe he was looking up at where the Enterprise was, because the sound would come from the Enterprise?
Possible. I think they had a roof over their heads, but you know, I'm not going to disagree with you on this one. I wonder whether if because you've got like three or four crew persons... three of them, didn't you, in the same place, when you're having a conversation over the comm badge, that all three comm badges are actually, you know, playing back at the same time, like a mesh audio network.
Maybe.
Maybe not.
Yeah, they're gonna have to have a good echo cancellation system.
Yes, that is true.
And have all the audio in sync.
Well, notwithstanding the fact that those comm badges seem to have a phenomenal battery life.
Yeah.
So
and a range of 40,000 kilometers or something.
Yeah, that is a bit daft. Unless they hollow project relay stations between where they are and where they're talking to. I don't know.
Right, next to the hollow projected loudspeaker.
Yeah, exactly. So my quote of the week was in that scene, and it was difficult because there were a lot of possibilities for quote of the week in this episode.
Yeah.
But mine was just the heavily ironic way that Riker said, "Thank you, Data, for carrying out my orders so precisely."
Yeah.
Because
Data did exactly
what he was told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly.
Be there before it's too late.
Be there before it's too late. Yeah.
And then he spent about a minute or so explaining how he managed to, you know, to gain 47 minutes.
But Riker didn't stop him.
Nope. Not this time.
He let him continue.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Riker agrees to attend the execution, which will be carried out by disintegrating the fugitives.
Again, this disintegration is not instantaneous, you know, the vase or I don't know what it was.
It
faded. So, yeah, I would have expected, you know, if it's disintegrated, then poof, it's gone.
Oh, that's right. No, I remember now. So the image of the vase was then overlaid with what looked like a television that wasn't plugged in.
Yeah.
Sorry, television where the aerial wasn't plugged in. And then it kind of just faded into nothingness.
Yeah.
And even the warm-up process of the disintegration device, where you had like a lighting effect coming up from the two sides.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think about the visual effects that the production team are capable of, because we've seen some amazing effects so far in this series, that was really poor.
Yeah.
That was just a basic chroma swipe effect.
If you say so.
Well, where they take an item or a piece of colour and they just overlay that colour with an image from somewhere else.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's exactly what happened.
And that's what it looked like. So, disappointed about that. Probably lost the budget.
in the costume.
Yeah, but the ski suits.
No, the Riker's one.
Oh, right, yes. Yes, or combing his body hair or something. I don't know. Riker makes a speech about how Beata is trying to hold back evolution, which can't be done, and warns her that she'll just make a martyr out of Ramsay. At the last second, literally before Trent is about to push the little devicey thing that was going to disintegrate Ramsay, she relents and says that the council will adjourn to reconsider.
Yeah, I think just the scene before she explains the process, and she said, "Oh, we've done everything we could gently or diplomatically resolve this conflict, but we couldn't. So the only thing left to do is to kill them." I mean,
didn't do anything.
Maybe there's there's something in between, you know. I don't know. Arrest them, judge them. You know,
maybe they don't have a jail.
Oh. Yeah, why didn't I think about that?
They have
that?
nowhere to store them.
Yeah, so good then.
Also, what was the... Oh, I can't remember the name of the episode now. The one where the away team went down and they went down again and then they went down again. It was the Love Fest Island.
Justice.
Is that what it was? Oh, yes. Yeah, no, that was it, because that's exactly the what I'm talking about. Is the approach of, if you do something, you know, totally trivial that's against the rules, you die.
Yeah.
So maybe Angel One has taken the judiciary from whatever the name of that planet was. I can't remember. Maybe.
Yeah, I can't remember either. But they were running.
I never saw anybody running on Angel One.
No.
No. So, so maybe it's different then.
Yeah.
I noticed when the council left to adjourn to reconsider, that two males left at the same time as the females. And I was wondering whether they were either like token male advisors of the group or if they were just simply attendants. I couldn't work out, because had they been just attendants, then I would have expected them to have followed behind. But one of the males actually went in the middle of the group. Because I don't know whether you noticed, there were two colours of uniform for the female counsellors. There was a more bluey-purpley one and a more purpley-pink one. So I didn't know whether that bluey represented maybe two levels of authority, perhaps.
Maybe. But I like the name of your colours. Bluey-purpley and
purpley-pink. I can't actually remember what the colours were, but that's as near as I can get it.
No, but purpley-pink is good.
Yeah, yeah.
I know a little girl who would like purpley pink things.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't have any purpley pink filament
rolls
left
of
over.
PLA.
No, no. I've still got lots of fluorescent orange, which I can't get rid of. Oh, dear. We're almost done. Crusher informs Data that she has devised an inoculant.
Bingo.
Bingo. Exactly. Bingo. Bingo. Is that a reference to a Earth pastime?
Yeah.
Actually, I'll say this now. When Crusher called to the bridge and said bingo, she just waited for Data to question Bingo again, reveal the fact that he recognized it as a pastime from, you know, 20th century Earth. And she didn't say a word.
No, that was...
there must have been 20 or so seconds before she actually followed up the word bingo with something else. You know, if you...
Yeah.
It would literally be a case of, shut up, Data, I'm trying to tell you something.
Yeah. But no. But it was funny.
It was. Data then informs Riker that the Enterprise is ready for the away team to return. Riker instructs Data to maintain a lock on the away team and Ramsey's group, but to stand by for further instructions. Beata then returns and says she's decided to stay the executions, but she now exiles Ramsey and his followers to a remote region of the planet. It's not quite as hospitable as the rest of the planet, but she's confident that, if they work hard, they can make a life for themselves and be free to live as they please.
Yay. But couldn't that be considered as, you know, because that's the consequence of the Enterprise being here. Couldn't that be considered as a violation of the Prime Directive? That the simple fact that they were there made Beata...
Yeah.
It changed the way our society worked and exiled them. Because, you know, maybe they're going to be away for a while, but at some point in the future, I'm sure the two groups will meet again. And yeah, so it's
not necessarily. I mean, it's been 6-7 years since they exiled the first time, and they've not been found since. So I'd say it was pretty much a given that if they do go to this inhospitable or almost inhospitable region of the planet, that they're going to get left alone. I can't imagine why the I don't know what they're calling themselves, why the main group of natives would want to go and find them necessarily.
Not necessarily, but they were there for 6 years, but for 6 years they tried to hide, so they didn't make contact with the natives. Let's call them natives. But now they're going to be they're not going to be hiding. They're just going to be isolated. But if the group grows, then they're going to expand. I'm sure in 100, 200, 1,000 years, they're going to make contact with the native, and maybe in 100, 200 years, some of the natives will actually wander around and find them.
Probably does not, but there's nothing to say that another group of people might come to the discover the planet and land in another inhospitable region and set up a colony there and not be discovered for years. So I don't think it's going to make that big a deal.
Okay.
Thinking about your comment of whether Riker's interaction with the council has actually violated the Prime Directive, he didn't actually do anything. All he really asked, because Beyonce said to him, are you going to try and change our minds? And he said no. But all he did was insist that they think again about what they're doing.
Yeah, which is...
which was enough to put doubt into Beata's mind for them to then go away and think about it. And I don't know how many people voted for and against the stay of execution, but it must have been enough of them.
Yeah, Matt, it's that's what makes this episode very interesting. Mm. That, you know, did they or did they not change the outcome of the story? Is that or is that not a violation of the Prime Directive? And there's no definitive answers in the episode, and that's an interesting part.
This, to me, is transparent aluminum. Think going back to The Voyage Home.
Yeah.
Where Scotty gives, I can't remember his name, Professor, what's his name, the formula for transparent aluminum. And Bones says to him, are you not changing the future by giving him this information? But Scotty then comes back with, how do we know that he didn't invent it in the first place?
Sure, yeah, true.
I appreciate that it's a hack. You are potentially changing the future. But are you changing the future to such an extent that the future as was doesn't happen again? I know it's the butterfly effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some small thing that happens or changes on one side of the world affects something on the other. But
something happened with Tipple's grandmother or great grandmother or ancestor when she gave someone on Earth the Velcro in an episode of Enterprise. Don't remember which season, when they were recounting when Tipple said that actually the first time the Vulcan came on Earth was not the first time.
Yes.
So, did the Vulcan give the Velcro? As you said, how do we know they didn't invent that in the first place?
You could argue that they're violating the Prime Directive by being there in the first place.
Yeah.
Because any interaction with something or someone that you wouldn't have had you not been there is going to influence either the way they think or the way they behave or something about it. I mean, the voyage home was slightly different because you're going into the past and potentially changing, reshaping the future. In this case, it's not the case because their future hasn't happened yet.
Unless you're from the future. Yeah, time travel.
it's a real.
That's not,
It's a real gray area.
Yeah.
Anyway, we were doing a review. Let's get this finished. The away team returns to the Enterprise and is inoculated by Dr. Crusher against the virus. Captain Picard, although hoarse, has returned to the bridge, and the ship then heads for the neutral zone. Now, almost my quote of the week was a single word. Well, it wasn't a single word. It was about four attempts to say a single word by Picard, and it goes something like, "Engage."
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah, absolute class. Actually, I forgot to mention something. When the away team... Actually, no, scrap that. I didn't forget to say it. It's still relevant. Try again. When the away team beamed off Angel One and all the native citizens were watching them go, it seemed similar to the disintegration of the Vars.
Yeah, that's true.
And if they've never seen people beaming in and out of their location before, then they might have thought that they had actually been disintegrated rather than beamed up, because they may not have known what beaming up was. Don't know. Just a thought.
Or they can now question their disintegrator and think, maybe people are not disintegrated, but they are beamed somewhere else.
I don't think that's any better, to be honest.
No.
That's like the thing on Saru's native planet. Oh, God, what was that thing called?
Yeah.
Where they get taken, thinking they're going to a better mm-hmm. place, but they're not. They're just getting destroyed.
Disintegrated. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So, thus endeth the episode. I thought that was a really good episode. I thought the storyline was great. I'm still scarred from the acting. Well, Jonathan Frakes specifically. I thought like I said earlier, the romance / love scene was a bit cheesy.
It's just that scene.
Yeah, I think the one thing that this episode has going for it is it was incredibly funny. There was a lot of comedy in it. There was a lot of, and I do think there was a lot of improvisation going on.
It seems like
the script. They were told to say things, but they weren't told how. So they let the scene pad itself out by Riker appearing in the suit, Riker being presented with the suit, and stuff like that. And it worked really well. It came across really naturally.
Yes, which is something you can only do if your actors are getting along together and getting along with their characters. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very interesting episode. We don't know, as I said earlier, where the virus comes from, what's the real effects, but that's the B plot, so we don't really care. Story wise, very, very interesting. Well produced, well played. I really enjoyed this one.
I think if I had to pick up one thing to complain about, and to be fair, nothing I've said so far is a genuine complaint, it would be the visual effects. I was genuinely disappointed by the visual effects.
Yeah, it's 1987, so...
I get it. I get that. But they have produced visual effects significantly better than that before.
Have they? Except, the Enterprise and so on, that's the effect that comes back every week, so they can make very, very well-produced effects for that, because they're going to reuse everything in other episodes. They can invest money, but did they have better effects in other episodes that are not related to the Enterprise? I'm not sure.
See, now you've said that, I'm doubting myself.
Yeah, that's what I do.
But doubt me.
Make everyone dub themselves.
Yeah, okay, all right. maybe. I think my expectations were probably a little bit too high on that one then.
Probably. Mm. But that's what happens when everything else is spot on. So now you see that the effects are 23 years old.
33
mm. years old. Ooh. You know, when there's a bad story with bad acting and bad music and bad production, then you don't see the bad special effects.
That's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah,
I feel better now. Thanks.
Yeah, very good episode. I liked it a lot. Mm. It's one of those that I enjoy rewatching.
I've never given any thought to rewatching particular episodes. I'm
not saying that I'm going to someday sit and say I'm going to rewatch Angel One. It's just that if I happen to rewatch it, then that's not one of those that I go, oh no.
Yeah. You know? So I didn't mean that to come across the way it did. I wasn't suggesting we pick an episode and go back and watch it again. It was more of a case of, would I go back and watch the series again?
Which is what I'm doing right now.
Yes, but you're doing.
I've watched it.
You're doing it for a reason. Would you have done it anyway?
I'm also watching the. I'm on the end of season four or five. So
okay,
just be when we started watching when I restarted watching Encounter at Farpoint, I decided that I was gonna watch the 7 seasons.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
And then I watched them again for the show. So.
So you started watching them at the same time and then diverged. So you sped ahead with the rest of it and then you're following it up.
And excellent. I've actually created a new profile on Netflix so that it wouldn't conflict with my progression on my own profile with the progression of the podcast.
Ah, okay. And what have you called that profile?
DGH.
Hey, excellent. We have our own genuine Netflix profile. Fantastic.
Yeah.
did you know that was the first mention of the Romulans in TNG?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
We're so used to have them around, so no, I didn't.
Yeah, no, it was the first time they were ever mentioned.
Okay.
No,
I didn't know that. Interesting.
What else can I tell you about this episode? Because I've got a whole bunch of stuff in front of me. A lot of it is kind of over-technical. It's one of only two episodes where LaForge is in command.
Yeah.
The second one is later on in this season. Okay. Yeah, that's about it, really.
Okay, cool. Interesting episode. I liked it. Hopefully we're going to have more episodes of this quality in the future.
It's nice to have another episode that wasn't on the ship.
Yes.
Because we have had a lot of episodes on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine they're quite expensive to produce where they're, you know, on location. But that having been said, you will notice that the expanse of the areas that they are filming on location are really, really small. So the council like chamber looked really, really tiny and crammed.
They have like two or three sets and that's it.
Yeah, but they're small. They're not like... Mm-hmm. I mean, the room that Yar and Troy and Riker were in when he was about to put his slave suit on, or whatever you want to call it, that did seem like a much bigger room. But the other one seemed quite compact.
Yeah, maybe it has also to do with the fact that it's a 4x3 picture format. We already talked about that. That they have to,
of course.
You know, they have to get closer together to fit on the screen. So it makes you think that everything is tighter.
Yeah, and I think that was also it's not just the 4x3; it's also the resolution. The the 70s and 80s, I think probably even the 60s, 70s and 80s, saw a lot of close-up camera angles in television. Mm-hmm. Whereas nowadays you seem to see a lot of wide shots, a lot more wide shots of things and scenarios, because you've got a lot more clarity, a lot more
resolution. 4,000 pixels.
Well, exactly.
4,000 pixels on each line. So back then it was 600 and, well, in Europe it was
65 in UK and Europe, and 400 and something. Was it 525?
That was 625 in Europe.
Yeah. It was either 480 or 525 in the US. I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's not a lot of clarity.
No.
Anywho, if we're done then that brings to an end to our review of Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1, Episode 14, Angel 1.
So, we're still looking for a co-host for episode 50 of this fine podcast, because I'm going to be on vacation, as we told for like the past 3 weeks or something. So if you want to help Dave co-host this show, you don't have anything to do, actually. You just have to watch the episode and be there and interact.
Yep, I'll do everything else.
Dave is going to...
Like I do every single week.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to become a regular co-host with me.
I love doing this show.
Yeah.
For the next week or two.
Is getting old.
It's fun.
So yeah, if you want to co-host the show, send an email. We'll give you the address later on. Actually, if you want to be a co-host with, you know, a friend or family or things like that, or a group of 23, you can also send an email to Dave. It's going to be fun. You know, like we did last time, it was a real mess, but it was fun.
Make a note to create a filter on my email to send those ones straight to the bin. But yeah, we will be recording on... Wednesday, August the 5th, I think.
Yes. That's what you said last time.
So, or thereabouts. There's a bit of flexibility there if you can't do that particular time. So, yeah, please do let us know. So, thank you to everybody who has downloaded our previous episodes. We are in awe of the fact that you are spending just a little bit of time to listen to this, you know, mashup of opinion that we push out each week. You can help us spread the love for this show by setting up a very low frequency transmitter in your back garden and transmitting our web address around the world using Morse code. Or if you simply don't have the lateral or vertical space to install an antenna big enough for that frequency, as a quarter wave antenna at 3 kilohertz would be 25 kilometers long, you can simply share our website on social media.
Yeah, 25 kilometers long. Maybe it's a bit too much. But anyway, our website is tlgreyhut.org, where you can find our show notes, our reviews. You can leave a comment. You can, if you dig enough, you can find the planning. You can find a list of our previous co-hosts, guests. An outdated list of answers to our 7 questions.
Indeed.
Which still hasn't been updated.
We'll get around to it one day. It's just occurred to me that a 25-kilometer antenna might fit around the Large Hadron Collider tunnel.
There you go.
So
if you don't know where you put your antenna, you can still, you know, come here in Geneva.
Yeah, exactly. You can also send an email.
In Sweden.
You can also send an email. Our address is feedback@tlgreyhot.org.
We are mainly on Twitter @TEGHpodcast and also on Telegram @t.me/TEGHpodcast. And that's the only place where you will get the link to our unlisted live YouTube stream. And once again, we would like to thank Lainey for joining us for this recording.
Absolutely. We should probably also mention Facebook, because it's not in our notes. We're on Facebook as well. Facebook.com/TGH podcast.
Yep.
Thanks, as always, to Memory Alpha. We have based our review of this week's episode on their work, and I have corrected some of their work as well, which is great. And that is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution non-commercial license.
The rest of this show is released under a Creative Commons by Attribution share-alike license. See our website for details.
This podcast is a part of the Other Side Podcast Network. Check out more of the shows and our phenomenal website at otherside.network.
Absolutely. Our next episode will be a review of Star Trek The Next Generation Season 1, Episode 15, 1100101, which is actually the number 201.
Indeed. But apparently the number 201 has no relevance whatsoever.
No. I was just curious to know what this number was.
Yes. There are theories as to where the episode number comes from. We can probably talk about those next week.
Well, that brings us to the end of this show. Thank you, Dave. It's always a pleasure to co-host this show with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
On those Wednesday nights.
Yes. Yeah, it's great fun. I love watching the episodes. And yes, we do tend to have probably a lot more fun that ends up in the final show.
Yeah. Yes.
To be fair. But if you come along to the live recordings, go to our Telegram channel, then you can appreciate the full car crash that is this recording.
Will you be back next week?
Sorry?
Will you be back next week?
I certainly hope so. If I'm allowed to be, am I allowed? May I come back next week, Yannick?
Yes.
Thank you. I will be back next week.
Cool. You're very kind. In the meantime, take care of yourself. Stay home. Wash your hands. Ciao, ciao.
See ya. Hello and welcome to episode 47 of Tea Earl Grey Hot. Oh, see what happened. The away team, Bleem. Bleem me up, Scotty. When Trent returns to bring them back to their council, to the council. Bleh. So we are on to act two.
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 One, two.
De. Zwei.
De.
Yeah. Dos.
Duo.
Duo. You can also send an email. Our address is feed.
You've been listening to a member of the Other Side Podcast Network. Find more about our shows at othersidenetwork.com.